Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. It's time for your morning damage report, the last one of the week, actually. And things aren't too crazy. Right, Brett?
Speak for yourself, John. You don't know what kind of tempest is bubbling over inside my cranium.
It's bad in here, John. You might be very scared, and certainly there are important issues facing us. We are, after all, in day 4 of the Kavanaugh hearings, and we've moved past the portion that actually has Brett Kavanaugh, which is good for him because he won't be made to look like a fool on a constant basis if he's not actually there.
He's so white. Like, he's a kind of white. You know what I mean?
Yes.
He's like hiding in Norway kind of white. You know, like
when you always look tempest in your cranium. Yeah. I didn't think it'd be this particular type of tempest.
Sorry, he's so white that it like pushes the top of his head up towards the sky.
Uh huh.
And he has to constrain it.
I'm gonna be honest with you. I had not noticed that.
Go watch it.
We'll come back to that topic because there's other stuff we have to talk about too. So obviously that's still going on, and that is why throughout the entirety of today we're going to have the information for you to call up your senators to make your voice heard on the Kavanaugh nomination. But what we will be talking about today is a lot. Donald Trump had another rally, which had some serious talk about his belief that impeachment could be coming and who he blames if that does happen. So that'll be very interesting. Also, he tries to pronounce words. So we're going to end the week with a little bit of fun. Bad information, though, on the border. Both a personal story of a mother and son who have been perhaps irreparably harmed by their detainment, and new information on the regulations that are coming that will increase those sorts of situations in the future. We also have 2 guests, by the way. This is the week of 1,000 guests, and we've got 2 more awesome guests for you. Josh Fox, you might know from films like Gasland, will be joining us. He's going to be talking about his live traveling show that he's doing across the country right now. We're also going to be breaking down some of Donald Trump's environmental policy. And then we're going to be joined by Liz Watson, a Democratic congressional candidate in Indiana's 9th district, going up against Trey Hollingsworth, and she is going to recount a tale of the night that she went to a healthcare policy forum that he was supposed to go to and where he went instead, and I think you're really going to love it. But before we jump into all that, I did want to briefly mention one thing. Although I hate mentioning the person's name here, he's not banned here like he is in YouTube, you know, Google, Pinterest, MySpace, I'm trying to think of the obscure Chinese one that I used to know of. Anyway, he's banned there too. Now he's also banned on Twitter, and that is, of course, Alex Jones.
Alibaba?
Alibaba. He cannot shop on Alibaba. He cannot buy 1,000 welding machines for $10. So he is now banned on Twitter. Twitter had considered this before, and apparently there had been talk amongst the staff of banning him because of his clear, repeated violation of their standards. Jack Dorsey, the CEO, had intervened and stopped it from happening. But then after this week's tech forum at Congress, when he was personally harassed by Alex Jones and others there as well, they finally pulled the plug on Alex Jones.
I love it.
So what do you think about this?
You can anonymously ruin the lives of many people, or you can just kind of ruin, like, dox folks and spread information about where people live who have gone through terrible things. Mm-hmm. And then Twitter's like, free speech, I don't want to. But at one tech forum, you offend the wrong people and you're blackballed.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder. I mean, it's certainly the timing is suspicious. But I think that they have faced a lot of pressure for some time now to do something about this. Because if you're going to have standards and you're going to have penalties laid out for violating those standards and you choose not to enforce them on one particular person, that begins to look not like neutrality, but advocacy for that person and their platform.
It doesn't look like, I don't agree with that. I don't think it looks like advocacy. I think it looks
going to those lengths to protect him, you don't think?
No, it's not. No, I don't think in any way that it's advocacy. I think that's a messaging attempt from people on a certain side. I think the truth is. I think you just messaged that. But I think that's false.
Okay, I have a message for you later then.
But I think the truth is they're just scared. Like, they're CEOs and they're afraid to pull off Band-Aids. And they're afraid of what it's going to do to the reputation, which is why I think that
But they have banned other people.
Yeah, but they're afraid of the repercussions and the way it will look if they do ban this person. And they, I think, after enough pressure, they did succumb to the pressure, but the pressure was, it didn't, I mean, there's no way I could argue that it looked like advocacy.
Well, look, I will say, there's a million arguments that come out every time he's banned from somewhere, and it'll be here as well. People saying that it's censorship. I understand that's a position people hold. I 100% disagree. It's not censorship. He still has his website. Nowhere in the First Amendment does it say anything about private companies or about them being obligated to host your speech and pay for it.
Right. It's just violations of terms of service.
It's violations of terms of service that were very clearly laid out that he violated many times. He was put on a 7-day suspension like 2 weeks ago. He knew that this was a possibility, and he persisted. You know, in a slightly different way than Elizabeth Warren. So it's not censorship at all whatsoever. And I understand this is totally unrelated to this, but an argument that people have is that, sure, people like Alex Jones are not really in the media. What they do is they put out conspiracy theories, disinformation, they lie to you. But in the end, truth will win out.
Yeah.
And accurate information will beat them. And I think that that is a wonderful hypothesis that has absolutely no evidence to support it based on our experience on the internet. It doesn't. People believe these things. If you then show them counter information, they believe it stronger. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't spread good information. We should, in the hopes that we will reach people first, perhaps. But having wild conspiracy theories that involve targeting specific people, hounding them across the country as they move from place to place, ruining lives, harassment campaigns, racism and anti-Semitism and hate speech, and threats, by the way. He was banned on Twitter a couple of weeks ago for telling people to get their battle rifles to defend him. So all of that, I mean, yes, I can then come on here and say, well, we have a fact check on the battle rifles. Please don't kill people. I don't think that that really evens the playing field, unfortunately.
No. Yeah, I think, you know, when we first started getting to know each other, I would text you and you wouldn't know how to read it because I'm weird and my texts are strange. And then the more you know me, you know how to read it. For me and Alec, with the Alex Jones things, it's like you don't know how his fans are really following him. Are they following him earnestly? Like, oh, I really do believe that there are lizard people. Or are they following him because it's entertaining and ridiculous and fun? And I think it's a mix. And it's so hard for us to learn how to read these people who are following a crazy. And I do think, though, in the end, like you, that truth will win out and people will be sensible and will learn more about these followings and be able to determine the difference between, like, the people who earnestly believe in these insane conspiracy theories and the folks who are like, isn't this ridiculous? He's holding giant underpants.
Well, I want to be clear. That was not the position I articulated. I don't think truth will win out. But I will continue to try to spread it, even if it means that this show will never go anywhere. Because you know what? Believe something. Even if it means sacrificing everything.
I wrote
Swoosh. Anyway, I like making jokes about that, even though I love that message and the campaign. So I feel very conflicted about that. Anyway, really fast, I do want to move on to the Montana rally that Trump had. This is in Billings, Montana. And he, as he does, he talked about a lot of different things. Nobody knew what he was going to say next, including Donald Trump. And I want to just have a little bit of fun. Let's play this first video as he talks about the resistor inside of the White House.
The latest act of resistance is the op-ed published in the failing New York Times by an anonymous, gutless coward. You just look.
What is that? Anonymous.
Yeah. Trump, it's actually pronounced aneurysm.
Here's the thing. I act like I'm making fun of him, but I'm actually concerned about him. Why did a nurse not run up on the stage? Something was happening in his brain there.
Yeah, I think something is happening in his brain. It does seem like he's medicated or he's losing it. And that's not a good thing. Like,
it could just be the denture thing again. We've talked about that before. I think that is the least conspiratorial theory. He's an older man who's having problems with his dentures. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Many, many people use them. The prospects, if it's not that, are a little bit weirder.
The Russian bug is in his dentures, don't you see?
Interesting.
They planted it.
Okay, so we're going to come back to this after our first break. But before we do that, I want to play the next one. He has a theory about who it might be, or at least what sort of person it might be.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
He was, nobody knows who the hell he is, or she, although they put he, but probably that's a little disguised. That means it's she. But for the sake of our national security, the New York Times should publish his name at once. I think their reporters should go and investigate who it is. That would actually be a good scoop.
Wait, I think that they're actually working on that. I think the New York Times reporters probably are trying to find out who that is. So here, Donald Trump might actually get what he wants out of the New York Times. But anyway, we do have to take our first break. We will come back to this story a little bit later on. Maybe we'll speculate a little bit about who it might be. I did that with Piper Perabo yesterday. But we're going to take a break. When we come back, Josh Fox is going to be joining us, author, documentarian, activist. We're going to be breaking down his latest projects, talking a little bit about the environment after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. I am thrilled to be joined by our next guest, Josh Fox, the author of documentaries.
Anonymous.
Like Gaslight. Oh my God, I've had a Trump moment. Jesus. Josh Fox is the creator of Gasland, as well as a number of other critically acclaimed documentaries about the environment. Also the author of The Truth Has Changed joins us now. Josh, welcome to the show.
You have it there, and I have it here.
We have it here, okay? let our books combine.
And into the other room there to go grab it. Because I was like, oh, my God. I'm hearing about this, so this is exciting.
Yeah, there you go. There you see it. So, look, I'm curious both about the book and about your live performances that you've been doing, the Truth Has Changed Tour.com. What is your goal with the Truth Has Changed, and how has it changed?
Well, first of all, yeah, I should say I'm touring all across the United States right now. We've done a lot of these grassroots tours with Gasland, with How to Let Go of the World, with Awake, with all of the films. And so this is a tour that's a live performance. I think about it as a documentary, but it's a spoken documentary. Mm-hmm. It's a documentary that I narrate to you live on stage. The project originally was a commission from HBO where they were like, you know, they saw me on the road across the country. They saw me sort of being a Bernie Sanders surrogate and doing all these speeches. And they were like, we want you to do a one-man show. And we're going to tape that and we're going to put it on television. So I began to develop The Truth Has Changed. And it has been a year in the process. I have, I guess, should out myself. I've always been a performer. That's what I've always been in terms of my life history. From the age of 10 on, I was on stage. I have a theater degree. So my theater work actually comes from an investigation into issues, especially international issues. And so moving to documentaries was a very natural step. And this is unifying a lot of different aspects of my life: performing, writing, documentary, reporting. And there's a scoop inside of here and an explanation of what one of the things that's happening in America that I find extremely troubling, not just for the environment, but also for our media environment, our media climate, and our media ecosystem.
Well, you can't just leave us hanging. What is that scoop?
Oh, well, good question. So The Truth Has Changed is really about how our democracy and our media has been taken over by psychographics. Misinformation, propaganda, and it's that is happening in an atmosphere in which the climate has fundamentally changed. So we have a climate that is changed. We have a 5% wetter atmosphere, which is creating all of this incredible havoc, right? All these incredible storms and other places, extreme drought. We're seeing the extremes of the weather system being pulled till it breaks. In the same way, we're seeing that happening in our democracy. And for five long years, the anti-fracking movement, my two films, all the different things that we know about as information and science on fracking were smeared and maligned. And, you know, the oil industry put out a $50 million smear campaign against Just Gasoline itself. Two feature films were made about me and about that movement that were entirely made up of lies of the oil industry. As it turns out, well, we never really talked about this because we considered it punching down. You know what I mean? We weren't going to go into the muck with the smear merchants. Well, the people who did that, Andrew Breitbart, Philip McAleer, and a guy named Steve Bannon, so those people basically took over the world. It's not punching down anymore. So it needs to be talked about. And in the 2016 election, there were really incredibly nefarious techniques, very deeply sophisticated, of smear and misinformation that happened in that election. And they're worth really talking about, pulling apart, and understanding. And I come at that from a position of a person who was attacked by them for five long years. I feel like I was one of the beta tests for the kind of ways that this happens. So you see right now the Parkland kids being called crisis actors. Yeah. You see all these reports about how different movements were pushed by troll farms. Well, we talk a lot about Russia, okay, but we're not talking about the oil industry and their role in all of this. There's nothing that Russian bots did in the last election that the oil industry hasn't been doing for 10 years. And right now, ExxonMobil is just sort of sitting back there, you know, like Homer disappearing into the bushes as everything gets blamed on the Russians. But it's truth. The truth is that the oil industry is the major purveyor. And those smear merchants like Hill and Knowlton and the people who have contorted information that's led us into the Iraq War, that led us in to the Vietnam War, for years and decades postponed any regulation of smoking because they said smoking was good for you. And of course, those are the same people who are saying there's no such thing as climate change. And they're the same people who are saying that fracking is fine. And they're the same people now who are in the Trump White House and that all those people have been saying for years, black information is more prevalent than the truth. So this piece goes into how the truth has changed in the sense that we have a much harder time discerning the truth.
So, Josh, this is Brett. I have a question for you. You said earlier the word psychographic, and I've heard that a lot in terms of marketing and especially how people disseminate information on the internet. But what is the difference? Because previously people had heard the word demographic a lot. What is a psychographic and how is it used in this misinformation climate?
Great. Demographics is the same root as the word democracy, right? Demos is the people. Those are the people that understand facts and science, presumably. Psychographics. So demographics divide up people through a very simple set of characteristics: your age, your race, where you're from, how much money you make. Demographics. If you're white and you're living in the Ohio suburbs and you're 32 years old, we know something about how you're going to vote. If you're black, you're living in North Carolina, you're 67, you're female, we know something about how you're going to vote, right? So a lot of campaign information is based on demographics. Now, in America, we're getting less white, less rich, and less old, which is a good thing because it's more people who vote progressive, tend to vote progressive. So the Republicans and the conservatives had to figure out a new way of slicing up the electorate to push spheres of influence that we can't necessarily see. We understand the spheres of influence that happen when we're talking about race and class. But when we're talking about psychology, that's a whole nother ball game. Psychographics is intimate knowledge of your psychological profile. And what was happened at Cambridge Analytica is they had psychographic data on people. How does that happen? Well, a guy named Michael Kaczynski at Cambridge University's Psychometric Center discerned a way that he could discover your intimate psychological profile from looking at your Facebook data. Right. He said famously, if I know 70 of your likes, I know you better than your friends. If I know 150 of your likes, I know you better than your parents. If I know more than 300 likes, I know you better than you know yourself. So Cambridge Analytica harvested 4,000 to 5,000 data points on every adult American. OK, they know a lot about you. Google knows a lot about you. Facebook knows a lot about you. The reason why is because your cell phone is a constantly evolving, ever deepening psychological data test that you're filling out all the time. And that data is being sold. Big data is now a bigger commodity than oil. When they sell that data, that means advertisers know how to target you, not just demographically, psychographically. They're appealing to your internal instincts. Are you an open person? Are you a conscientious person? Are you an agreeable person? Are you a neurotic person? They know what makes you tick, and then they can target specific political messages to specific personality types. The truth has changed. They're getting in there and manipulating your psyche. It's like running a smear campaign against 200 million people at once because they can group your intimate data and market it. It's like, on a very simple level, this would be like running a Willie Horton ad that no one except racists could see.
Huh. Right. Wow. Well, Josh, I want to thank you for terrifying us. I have a whole new thing to keep me up at night this weekend.
It's only going to be defeated if we know about it. Right? We have to show it and we have to name it. It's like looking at the chemicals in the ground at fracking. These are the toxic data that's polluting our entire cybersphere. So we want to talk about that. It's in the book. It's in the performance. You know. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. Very exciting. So I can't wait to read the book. We gave people information on where they can find out about your tour. I think a lot of people are probably going to be very excited about that. So thank you, Josh, for joining us on the Damage Report.
Okay. Thanks, John. Always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be moving on to the border crisis. New information about regulations coming out of the Trump administration, how they plan to keep families in detention longer after this. Welcome back, everyone. Coming off of a fascinating interview with Josh Fox, I can't wait to read the book now, find out more about this, and hopefully figure out what we're going to do about this psychographic assault, which sounds like sci-fi, but it's actually happening right now. So I want to return to the Trump rally. There was a little bit more fun, and then it gets a little bit serious. So first, we've actually commented a couple times on him being up there with the people in the background. You know, that's how the politicians always do it, and the politician will say something, and in the case of Donald Trump, every once in a while he says something that's either odd, like how he mispronounced "amamamanus," or that facts that are not true, like the fact that you need photo ID to shop at a grocery store, which is just not true. And I will look to the people in the back to see if they react to reaffirm my faith in humanity, and I have, up until now, never had it work my way because they just go along with it clapping. But not in this case. So I want to play this next video where I saw Alyssa Milano had tweeted out this video. Someone was recording the reaction of a particular plaid shirted individual to what Donald Trump was saying.
To find things out that we didn't know, it's hard and harder to win than popular vote. Popular vote, you go to 3-4 states and boom, 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 you win the fight. It's like the 100-yard dash versus running the mile. You practice differently.
See, actually, if you're listening to the podcast, he just, what? Huh?
Literally. Huh? Literally says what?
And he says what to himself? Because I'm not sure. I don't know the individual. I can't get into his brain. Donald Trump, what he's saying about how it's easier to win, that doesn't even make any sense. But more so that he has been president for a year and a half, and he's still talking about the Electoral College versus the popular vote.
If you want a small, you don't need to move to Crazy Town, but if you want to spend a few hours in Crazy Town, watch an entire Trump rally.
I have never watched an entire Trump rally.
I haven't watched an entire one either, but I have watched more than I should of some. And everything he's ever said, he says. It's like I just saw Aerosmith in concert. And they do, every show is mostly like love in an elevator and like, you know, dude looks like a lady. All the hits, they give them to you. And Trump gives you all those things that have ever scored applause in any rally he's ever done since the beginning. There will be a lock her up moment. Mm-hmm. There will be an additional time when he goes, I can't believe I won the pop. I didn't win the popular vote. He says stuff like this.
Look at the fake news back there.
Fake news, failing New York Times.
He will do that.
It's like it's whatever he's gotten positive reinforcement, he's giving you the hits.
Well, look, I want to arm you with the knowledge needed to make your way through your day. So if you ever end up at a Trump rally, and especially if you're in the background, you need to be more careful than the plaid shirted fellow was, because that sort of face tomfoolery is not appreciated by the Trump campaign, as you'll see in this clip.
There we go. So you're seeing
a Trump staffer go and talk to the plaid shirted individual.
Well, at the beginning, you're just seeing some woman. You know, it's just like some woman walks onto stage and talks to this man, and then he disappears and she takes his place.
And that is not, I don't think, Zina Bash from the Kavanaugh hearings, although it does look like. By the way, if you can see the guy in the blazer next to her, that is the most Trump-loving young man in the country. He's got his blazer, his tie, his hat.
It's a hoodie with some kind of, or it's like a zip-up.
But it's got like the crest.
Yeah, it's got some kind of whatever union he's a trainee in, I don't know. Yeah. But then, so the obviously to me what has happened is there was the original guy that reacted strangely.
Yeah.
And then there were his two friends who were kind of up there alone. And so the Trump campaign sends a staffer and then like central casting Trump person to go.
To just go and then
immediately
they just do that. Yeah. Which, look, it seems ridiculous when you capture it on film, but obviously you want to have the right people standing behind you. It's a rally, blah, blah, blah. So I don't really even care that much.
I do want to go back to that point about how it is harder to win the electoral. It's not harder to win the Electoral College, but it was, I think it was hard. It's harder to set that up. Mm-hmm. It seems easier to have a system where the popular vote wins, you know, but it's harder to set up and maintain a system where two separate times the popular vote has failed to correspond to the system that we have.
Yeah, and so, really close together too, those times.
Yeah.
And so you could react in one of two ways. You could then go for the next 5 years saying constantly, it's more impressive the way I did it, even though less people voted for me. Or maybe you could say, look, I won. That's the way the system works. But I understand that our country is incredibly split. And so I am going to spend my presidency working to earn the votes of the people who didn't necessarily support me initially, but I hope that they will in the future.
Lock her up.
Or lock her up.
Lock her up.
Okay, so I do want to talk, though, about the border, because I read in The Atlantic a really sad story about a mother-son pair. This is Anita and Jenry, who had fled from Honduras and come into Texas. They were near McAllen, Texas, back in mid-June. Now, Anita had apparently been having a very hard life in Honduras. Her brother's leg was amputated, or arm was amputated in some accident. The drug gangs were causing a lot of problems in the region. She apparently was held at gunpoint at one time. So she feared for the lives of herself and her son and took them into Texas. They were, of course, detained. The son was taken away and spent more than a month away from his mother. Now, in this particular case, they were reunited eventually, which I guess is the good news. But you can see a picture of them if we bring this up. This is right before they're separated. Then they spend a month apart. And Jenry, the boy, was, as many have been, affected by this. He apparently started saying whenever someone went to touch him, he would start yelling, no touch, no touching. And when asked where he learned to say that, he said, at the place they had me. He apparently also, at one point, while crying, said, just take me back to jail. You're not my mom anymore. And this is after a month. And we know that many of these kids have already been separated from their parents for far longer than a month. So we're not supposed to care about Jenry or Anita. They're not really people. They haven't been permanently separated like by people who, you know, have had a family member killed by an illegal immigrant, anything like that. We're not supposed to care about them. But these stories are out there. And I don't think enough time is spent actually talking about them. Because we can see Anita and Jenry, thanks to the work of places like The Atlantic, we're trying to signal boost that message. But there are hundreds of families like that, that are still separated, that will always be separated. We should stop with the still separated. Those 500 kids are not seeing their parents again. They've already been moved to other parts of the country. Their parents, in most of the cases, have been deported. And they're out there. And if they do ever see their parents again, we're probably going to have a lot more Jenrys, a lot more just take me back to jail, a lot more you're not my mom anymore.
And that was the plan. That's what's so frustrating. It was to make their lives so miserable as to dissuade people from coming here to seek asylum.
Yeah.
That was part of the stated plan. And it worked, question mark. But it's never going to work. People are still going to want to find asylum in America because they still have hope that life is better here.
Yeah. It's sad, especially when you see the pictures and you see them. And she's said that the separation was so long. My son has changed so much. And the thing is, I also want to, I mean, we don't have a ton of time, but I do want to describe to you that now, as of this morning, the Departments of Homeland Security and Health and Human Services, apparently they put up a draft of a new regulation change. It's going to lead to a lot more situations like this. So in the past, there had been this thing, the Flores Settlement. This is an agreement that the federal government has used since back in the late 90s to govern what happens to children who arrive in the country without their parents. And those kids had been given special protections. You know, they're still held in, you know, facilities that we would not think are acceptable. But they received a little bit more protection. And a couple of years ago, back in 2015, a judge overseeing that Flores settlement declared that it also applied to children who arrive in the U.S. with their parents. So again, increasing the level of protection for those kids, which is a larger group, but not soon. So these new changes that are going into place are going to increase the amount of scrutiny needed for people to get out of this detention. It will lower the level of protections for the kids who are in detention now. It's going to allow them to be held in facilities that have not even formally gotten certification from the government yet. So lowering the standards for the facilities that already, we've talked about many times, have these kids in horrific situations. And it's going to allow the kids to be held for longer periods of time. And so you're going to see more of these sorts of stories in the future. This is not law yet. It is going to be under review for a few months. But as long as Donald Trump is president, we have no reason to believe that this will not be the policy of our country.
It is a signal that that is still their priority, and they're going to continue to fight. So we have to continue to fight.
I agree. We're going to take another break. When we come back, Liz Watson is going to join us. She is the Democratic candidate for Indiana's 9th district. We're going to be breaking down her race and her opponent after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Now we've got a profile of another great candidate who's moving forward towards the general election this November. We're joined on the Damage Report now by Liz Watson, Democratic candidate for Congress in Indiana's 9th district. Liz, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Great to have you here. There. It took Skype a little bit, but we got you there. So one of the reasons I like doing these profiles is to learn a little bit about other parts of the country. I'm not that familiar with the 9th district of Indiana. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Okay. So the 9th district in Indiana is a district that touches the Indianapolis suburbs and also the Louisville suburbs and includes a lot in between of rural areas. There are a lot of folks here who are struggling to afford to fill their prescriptions, for whom the real economy isn't working. You know, the jobs report is out today. And of course, my opponent is saying because there are so many stock buybacks and CEO pay is skyrocketing that the economy is working great. It's working great for the billionaire class. It's not working great for the people who actually do the work. And that's what we see here in Southern Indiana day in and day out. People who work very hard and who struggle living paycheck to paycheck and a lot of despair and a terrible opioid crisis that's very much connected to the fact that the economy is not delivering for working families.
And unfortunately, that's a story that we hear in a lot of districts. So you mentioned there the prescription costs. I wanted to ask you about healthcare because I read a story where you had gone to a healthcare policy forum, and your Republican opponent, Representative Trey Hollingsworth, was supposed to be there, but he had other plans. Where was he that night?
Well, the night of the candidate's town hall on healthcare in Johnson County, I went and met with a bipartisan group of doctors and folks from Johnson County, from Greenwood and Franklin, representing healthcare groups, representing a group of concerned parents whose kids are suffering high pediatric cancer rates. I went because I was invited, and it was the right thing to do to go and listen. And when you show up and listen, you get good ideas. And instead of attending, Trey Hollingsworth decided to go to a high-priced fundraiser at Ruth Chris Steakhouse, a fancy steakhouse in Indianapolis. So he listens to dollars. I listen to people.
Well, look, Ruth's Chris, quite fancy. I like it. And it's not Morton's or anything, but it's pretty good. But still, yeah, that doesn't show the right focus necessarily when you're attempting to get elected. I did want to ask you, though, about your approach to healthcare. What direction do you think as a country we need to go to fix these problems that you've identified in the way we deliver healthcare?
we can walk and chew gum on this. We still have 48,000 people in the 9th district who are uninsured, and we have so many people who have insurance but are skipping medications, which we know can be life-threatening, or who are about to go bankrupt because they're paying out of pocket above and beyond what their health insurance covers. I believe we start by not breaking the Affordable Care Act, which is what my opponent is trying to do. But then we need to have a vision for how we're actually going to cover every single one of us and how we're going to bring our costs down. And I think Medicare for All is the right approach to that. I think it would clearly reduce administrative costs. We just saw from the Mercatus study that it would overall reduce our healthcare costs over $2 trillion, by $2 trillion over a 10-year period. It would allow for the negotiation of prescription drug prices. Now, what we've seen out of this Congress is an absolute unwillingness to bring down our drug prices to allow for that negotiation. And when we look at my opponent, he is the poster child of the corruption and greed in Washington that is stopping Americans from being able to afford their health care. So he has taken tens of thousands from the insurance industry, from the pharmaceutical industry, and then turned around and refused to do what the public needs, which is bring down our healthcare costs. But he is happy to vote to break the Affordable Care Act, to refuse to negotiate prescription drug prices, to allow for junk plans, and to take us back to the bad old days when people with pre-existing conditions couldn't get insurance, when having a pre-existing condition was a death sentence.
Well, it sounds like those industry donations to him have produced a good return on the investment there. He's a fairly junior congressman. He's running for re-election, I believe, for the first time. What has he accomplished in his year as a congressman for the 9th District?
So Trey Hollingsworth paid $4.5 million for his seat in Congress. He paid $3 million, and then his dad started a super PAC and put in $1.5 million, and the two of them together bought our seat out from under Hoosiers. He's a Tennessean who decided to waltz in here in 2016, taking advantage of the chaos down ticket from Trump to buy our congressional seat out from under us. And then his singular accomplishment during his term in Congress has been to give himself a $4.5 million tax cut. So he paid $4.5 million. He got a $4.5 million tax cut. He broke even. He wants to go back and double his money. I don't think so. And Hoosiers don't want that to happen.
Wow. Yeah. So I saw in his background that he was a businessman. I guess that's a particular form of business. But your background, actually, you have a background in workers' rights law. And that's a topic that thankfully has been talked about a good bit this week because of Brett Kavanaugh's nomination and his history in that area. How would you rate the Trump administration, what you've been seeing in terms of national policy having to do with workers over the past year and a half? What has your reaction been with someone in a background in this area?
So, you know, if you look at the big picture, right, the idea from this tax law was trickle-down economics. We're going to give a tax cut, 83% of the benefits will go to the top 1% in giant corporations, and somehow that's going to trickle down to workers. The administration promised everybody's going to get a $4,000 raise. That did not happen. In fact, we're seeing wages in Indiana, real wages, are falling. And that's directly related to the policies of this Congress. We have seen, as soon as the 115th Congress came in, which is Trey Hollingsworth, immediately they went to take away overtime pay, to roll back the overtime rule that you can think of as the minimum wage for the middle class. They went to take away safety and health protections that keep our guys and gals in the building trades safe on the job here in Indiana. Trey Hollingsworth voted to do that. They went to take away discrimination protections. And of course, you know, anything that would actually help to increase the bargaining power and increase the money in people's pockets, which is what needs to happen in order to stimulate consumer spending, right, and make the economy go around, they refuse to bring up for hearings and votes. So my opponent has co-sponsored the Right to Work for Less legislation at the federal level to gut labor unions. And of course, has said nothing about the $7.25 minimum wage here in Indiana, which leaves families living and working in poverty.
Well, Liz, I want to thank you for joining us. Your website is lizforindiana.com if people want more information, and good luck in your race.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. We're going to take one more break. We're going to close out the week as we always do, taking a look back, seeing what we learned after this. So much happens every single week, and so we like to end with a segment we call This Week I Learned. We learn so much each week that a new universe springs into existence. So look, I will say what I learned, I guess, is that you can get a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court without ever revealing anything you've ever thought or said to anybody. And that's just totally cool. It's an exercise of brute political force.
Well,
we have the votes. We just put you in.
Right. But you also, like, Kavanaugh is so close to getting it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's essentially like escape velocity. He just needs to stay on target. And just once he's out in space, he can do whatever he wants. But mm-hmm. he's been subtly signaling, like, what he would do. But now he just is, if I don't say what I would do for another 2 days, he'll make it.
Yeah, and there is every reason to believe that he is an insane ideologue. He could end up being the most conservative person on the court. Our hope, and how sad of a hope is this, is that he won't be as bad as Clarence Thomas. Maybe, but probably he
will be. Talk about somebody who doesn't say anything. Clarence Thomas never asks a question.
Yeah, that's a good point. So just absolutely devastating. And also, I didn't learn this week. I learned this, over the period of time. But again, reminder, the Supreme Court is an amazing reason to decide your vote on a presidential election. Because you vote for a person, then they get 2 Supreme Court judges in a year and a half. And that sets the stage for how politics is going to play out for multiple decades. Because again, and I try to keep reminding this, like our dream is, okay, we get past all of this, we push past it, and then we get an awesome progressive president. Who will then have a majority conservative Supreme Court filled with people like Kavanaugh who's going to try to strike down everything that he does. So that's my fear. But that's what I learned. Let's talk about what you guys learned. You tweeted in. Mike Lake learned that although federal judges are among some of the most intelligent people in government, they're incapable of clearly answering simple yes or no questions. That is their one qualification to get through. Dylan Armstrong learned that we need a recall system for SCOTUS judges like we do judges at the state level. I mean, technically, they can be impeached. But that doesn't happen, and it probably won't. Let's see. Joe Connors learned that people hate Colin Kaepernick, but they can't explain why without being 100% hypocritical. And Francis Maxwell was on the show yesterday to explain that. They know they hate him, but they thankfully don't feel comfortable clearly stating why. They might get banned from Twitter for that. Let's see. Angel learned the definition of lodestar, and apparently that Merriam-Webster is friggin' psychic. Had you heard lodestar? Before this week?
We had a conversation about Lone Star from from Spaceballs. Yeah.
I think they're related.
Yeah,
I don't 100%. Know exactly how.
Maybe. Load Runner, I played. Home Star Runner. Load
Star Runner.
I know.
Yeah.
Sparkling.
Time to do the emails.
That's more strong bad.
That is, yes. But we learned it. And let's see, what else did we learn? Lewis learned that real Donald Trump has 100 pictures of Comey and Mueller hugging and kissing. So here's the thing. I don't believe that there are 100 pictures of Comey and Mueller hugging and kissing. But if there are, why does Trump have them? Doesn't that seem a little bit weird?
Why are they above his bed?
We did not learn that.
On the ceiling.
This is where we talk about what we learned. We didn't learn that.
I thought it was what we made up this week. Sorry.
Yes. Okay. We'll make up others. That would be a different one. Brianna Davidson learned that Bob Woodward was put on this earth for no reason other than to save us from our own stupidity. And number 2, that we are in a bigger mess than I ever even imagined we were. So again, to look back over what this week should be remembered for, there's the Kavanaugh hearings. That's the most important. But how crazy is it that we got the Bob Woodward book revelations, as insane as they were, which were then pushed out of the news because of the resistor inside of the White House, the op-ed in the New York Times?
Yeah, but one reinforces the other.
It does. And by the way, the book will come out in a couple of days. It'll be back in the news. I hope that they left some of the juiciest tidbits for the release. But yeah, both should, I think, scare us about what's actually going on inside of the White House and what's not, including thinking.
What I learned this week is I forgot to take the Nike ad off the thing for one of the videos.
Yes.
And Henry.
Yes.
Jenri is actually Henry.
You learned that, but I didn't.
No.
I have learned nothing.
I learned also I wasn't.
And I proceed in a state of ignorance. But hopefully you won't. Thank you for joining us for the course of the week. It's been an awesome week. And the damage report next week, even better. Probably not. But let's roll the dice together. I'll see you then. You're listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Arola. I'll see you soon.